Okay, that song was sung by the KKFI Chorus for Social Justice. It was actually recorded last week, but the song was written for a rally at Jobs with Justice on January the 6th, 1991, some 23 years ago. So even though that is, like I say, some 23 years ago, the push to get some sort of health care universal plan or something that covers all or most of our citizens has been going on for about a century. So even but the question is that they ask in that song, health care must be for all of us. We're going to be talking about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act tonight, and I think we can safely say that we're not at the point where everyone has health care yet, but there are definitely some positive signs, and I think we'll talk about some downsides as well to the Affordable Care Act. Tonight we have a really great panel to discuss the issues. We've got Tiffany Wheeler and Brandon Dang from the Organizing for Action, Kit Wagner, ACA Specialist for Region 7 of Health and Human Services, Alice Kitchen, social worker and well-known Kansas City activist, Frank Neff, ACA activist with MoveOn.org, and Barbara Schneider, a senior citizen ACA activist. Is that a good enough introduction there, Barbara? Okay. Let's hear a little bit from Brandon and Tiffany. Just tell us a little bit about your what you guys are doing as far as the ACA is concerned.
Okay, great. Again, my name is Tiffany Wheeler, and I'm with Organizing for Action. And what we are a grassroots organization here in our community to push the issues that people voted for in the election of 2012. And how we are helping out in the community about Obamacare is that we are getting the facts out about Obamacare and telling people how they can sign up for it. And Brandon has actually signed up through the marketplace for a plan.
Good evening. I was just basically asked to come and speak about my personal experience with the Affordable Care Act. And long and short, what it has provided me with is flexibility and options that I didn't previously have. Just a little story. I was raised by my grandmother because my mother actually passed at an early age. And my grandmother, she sacrificed her golden years to raise me. And so she was able to send me to some of the best schools available in Kansas City, which ultimately led to me being able to leave to go to college. And so I did leave when I was 17. I've been gone for quite some time. And unfortunately, recently I found that my grandmother is suffering from diminished vision. And so the last couple of years I've been struggling with the decision to return to Kansas City so that I could be a little bit closer and be there for her. But I've not been able to do so because I do have a pre-existing condition. condition. I suffer from a heart problem. And what I found was a lot of times that my insurance coverage was based upon me being employed. And so through the Affordable Care Act in December, I was able to return home because I'm no longer tied to an employer in order to receive coverage. So now I'm able to take care of myself and also take care of my grandmother, and I'm really grateful for that.
Okay. Well, one of the things that we talked about just before we went on air, the three overarching things that that the Affordable Care Act was implemented to accomplish was to increase access, to improve quality of care, and to decrease costs. Well, let's spend a little time talking about access. You know, we can have a love fest for a while. I mean, there are really some good things about Obamacare that are, I don't know if we should call it ACA throughout, Obamacare throughout. I'll say ACA. The no pre-existing conditions that you can't prevent you from getting insurance, I think, is a tremendous improvement, and any humane society needs to have something like that, of course. My own grandson is on my I'm a retired federal employee from the Social Security Administration. My 22-year-old grandson has been on my insurance, and he was on my insurance when the Affordable Health Care passed, and will as a result of that have health care until he's age 26, and he'll have to go out and find it on his own. Obviously, the Medicaid expansion has signing up people through Medicaid has increased access. I know there's a whole lot of people here that have a whole lot of information about this. So who would like to speak about the increased access to health care that we have under the Affordable Care Act?
Okay, thanks, thanks, Bill.
Remind them who you are when you start speaking.
My name is Kit Wager. I work for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services for the Regional Director's Office, which is based here in Kansas City. And we serve four states, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, and Nebraska. And one of the main goals of the Affordable Care Act was to reduce the number of uninsured in the United States. We were more than 50 million people nationwide, about 830,000 people here in Missouri are without health insurance. And what happens when people are without health insurance is they put off health care, even if they need it, because they can't afford to pay for it. Well, when that happens, when their condition tends to get worse, they end up in hospital emergency rooms. And hospital emergency rooms are the most expensive form of health care ever devised by man. And this isn't a knock on the quality of care at hospital emergency rooms, but it's not a good place to get your basic health care because they just patch you up and send you on. What the Affordable Care Act tries to do is say, look, we're drowning in costs, these 7, 8% increases in health costs every year and health insurance costs has to stop. We're going to turn this upside down. Instead of saying, okay, we'll just keep paying for more and more people who have acute episodes, we're going to try looking at the studies that have actually been done that found you can save money by providing more primary care. We'll expand the Medicaid program nationally. That was the goal of the law. And for people who are moderate income, well into the middle class, we'll give tax credits to help them pay, basically discounts on health insurance, because most people, let's face it, if you don't have insurance through your job, you don't have insurance because most people can't afford it. The average household income in the United States is about $50,000 a year. The average family insurance plan is about $15,000. Who is able to spend a third of their income on health insurance? Almost no one. So the goal of the law was to increase access by helping people get insurance. And in doing that, they would have the ability to go to a primary care doctor, get care before a problem becomes acute, when it's a lot cheaper to deal with, and not only less expensive, but involves a lot less ongoing care if you can catch things early. So by giving people access to care, it's actually, the goal is to actually push down the overall cost by catching things earlier At the same time, we increase access. I mean, it really is a self-perpetuating cycle that we can lower the costs, overall costs, and improve the quality of care that the average person gets.
Yeah, as long as you're on that, speak a little bit about some of the wellness things that are covered that weren't covered before.
Right. One of the things the law says is that all insurance plans, except for a few that are called grandfathered plans that were in effect in 2010 when the law was passed, they are exempt from this. But other plans are required to cover preventive care now without charge to the patient. So no copayment, no deductible, anything. This includes things like mammograms, pap smears, colonoscopies, and much more routine things such as vaccines for kids, vaccines for adults as well. But especially for kids, I mean, it really makes insurance a lot more valuable. Contraceptive coverage if women are in childbearing years. A whole, if tests for asthma, tests for high cholesterol, just a whole range of things. Again, the goal is to catch things early and it's a lot cheaper to have somebody control their high cholesterol than to pay for 3 days in intensive care because they had a heart attack.
Yeah, I was trying to start this by focusing on access. You can't really talk about one without talking about the costs as well. But since you bring up the costs, talk about historically, it's always been a fee-for-service thing with doctors and how, and rather than looking at outcomes at all, I mean, is there, talk about how it tries to deal with that issue.
Sure. What we had traditionally was a system where it was called fee-for-service because you paid a fee for every individual service. And the medical industry had become adept at dividing everything up into lots of little individual little services so they could charge for everything. But the main effect of this was we had a system that rewarded mediocrity. If you went to the hospital, you got some care, and they didn't quite fix you up, they didn't quite do it right, or maybe you went into the hospital and you left with an infection you didn't have when you went in, well, what happened? You returned to the hospital. And the hospital could go, hey, ka-ching, you're back, we get to charge again. Well, what this law said was, look, we're not going to reward you for doing a bad job. We're going to reward hospitals that do a good job. So now there's a system in place, and this began in October of 2012, was when it went into effect for hospitals. A similar system like this goes into effect for doctors starting next January, where they get reviewed on how good a job they do. If a hospital is consistently below the national average in the quality of care it provides, it's going to get its Medicare payments dinged. That's not going to put them out of business. It's only 1% the first year, a maximum of 1%. But the next year it gets 2%. The following year it gets to 3% if they just can't get with it and improve the quality of program, of the services they provide. Now, on the other hand, if they are consistently above the national average, they get bonus payments. This is supposed to be revenue neutral. The hospitals that perform below average, the payments that are cut from them are going to be redirected to payment to hospitals as bonuses that do a good job. Well, what's going to happen? As hospitals compete to get out of that penalty category, or they compete to get into that bonus category, what happens to the average quality of care? Well, it starts moving up. We finally got a system in place that rewards good quality care instead of rewarding the provider who messed up and had you come back 5 times. So that's about half of the Affordable Care Act are those kind of payment reforms in order to lower the cost of care and to improve the quality of care.
Well, let me ask one just addendum to that, and then we'll move on from that. But it always struck me too with the fee for service thing. If you go in and you have an unnecessary X-ray, then they get paid anyway. So there's an incentive to run all kinds of tests that are not needed. Is that considered in the process as well, or maybe the overall outcomes thing kind of addresses that?
Yes, it's partially approached by that. Is addressed by that kind of how good a quality of care you're providing. But the other one, the other mechanism that's in there is the move toward what's called value-based purchasing. And instead of paying just for every procedure, that so they can just keep going ka-ching, ka-ching, and running up more and more procedures, they look at the quality of the outcome. How many people had to come back for care for the same thing you were supposed to have fixed them with before? How many people left and never really recovered? How many people, you know, all these statistics were already gathered. Researchers used them and things, but they weren't being used to affect payment methodology. And so that is involved in this. But then the other trend to even push this forward farther is the creation of what are called accountable care organizations. And these are groups of doctors who work as teams. Instead of having one doctor who doesn't know what your heart doctor is doing, who doesn't know what your podiatrist is doing, who doesn't know what your internist is doing, these doctors work together. And basically the way the system goes is if they can lower the cost while maintaining the quality of care or improving the quality of care they give, then they can keep part of the savings. That's the incentive for doctors to go on to the system. Because, frankly, we have to lower the cost of care. We can't keep going the direction we were. And so the direction that the Affordable Care Act takes is let's improve the quality of care, because if we can stop all these people from coming back all the time and do it right the first time, fix people the first time, then we don't have all that redundant care, and we can lower the overall costs, which not only saves everybody money, but will put downward pressure on health insurance costs, because ultimately health insurance costs depend on how much money is going to pay hospitals and doctors and other medical providers.
Yeah, Frank, you wanted to comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that one of the aspects of what he's been talking about, what Kit has been talking about, is it's my understanding that some of the ideas that are being implemented here are ones that have been tried out in some of the medical centers around the nation, and that one of the ideas that came from there was the idea of pursuing what happens to the patients when they leave the hospital. And some of the responsibility now has been put on the hospital to check up to see how those things are coming along. But one of the reasons why I wanted to put this in is one of the big criticisms about the Affordable Care Act is that it's such a big government operation. It's all the action of the government. They're the guys that are sitting up there and deciding what's happening. Well, that doesn't quite fit the experience that I understand in regard to these procedures that Kit's been talking about, is that they have come from inventive places around the nation where they have been experimenting with these ideas and trying this, trying that, trying something else to see what really is helping to produce a good outcome at a low cost.
Frank, as long as you're there, I was going to shift gears a little bit here anyway, and maybe Tiffany might want to, or anybody can comment on that wants to, but we are talking about access, and so, and I know one of the things you're going to come across the board here, if I don't talk about a little bit, is how important it is for people to sign up. So if you want to start on that, either one of you that want to comment on how things are going as far as signing up is concerned, and how important it is for people to sign up.
Why don't you pick up on that for a minute, and I'll talk about Kansas.
Okay. Well, it is very important for people to sign up. Like you said, if you don't have health insurance, the marketplace is available for you to sign up. And over 4 million people have signed up across the country, either through that marketplace or through the Medicaid expansion. So it's a great idea to get covered. It's like Kit has said before, catching these diseases early, getting the free preventive care that's covered under your plan. Each plan on the marketplace covers the very basics that you need. No matter if you get a bronze plan or a higher, a silver or a gold plan as well.
I just wanted to add, I'm aware of a good bit of what's been going on in the metropolitan Kansas City area, particularly by people working with Alice Kitchen and Sarah Starnes getting information out, and Barbara Schneider being one of the principal people getting the word out. On the Kansas side, it isn't quite organized the same way, but there are a number of things that are developing to get people in and enrolled, and I received a flyer here just the other day that's talking about four events that are going to be happening over in Johnson County, and so I would urge people that are in those areas and who are curious about the Affordable Care Act or who think that they want to get into it to try out these places. There's going to be one at Paola on March the 4th, one that's going to be in Olathe March the 5th, one in Mission on March the 6th, and another on March the 7th. And if you have a question on this, you can call 913-730-3687 and get more information about those places. They're going to have a number of the navigators that are people trained to help people sit down at the computer and actually do the job of getting online. So it's an opportunity for people over there to get rolling on being enrolled.
Yeah. And I just wanted to add one thing. One widely sort of misunderstood part of the law is that this is somehow a government program. These are all private insurance plans. The government simply set up a marketplace, so the private insurance companies would have to compete and make everything very clear and not cover some things and maybe not cover other things. So you're surprised when you go to the doctor that they all have to cover 10 basic, what are called essential health benefits. The other thing that's not widely understood is that, as I said before, you know, most people can't afford insurance on their own. What this allows, by buying through the marketplace plans, it allows you to pay based on your income. So you can, many people are eligible for very significant discounts. Many people will be able to buy quality, affordable health insurance for less than $100 a month. I mean, that's just really sort of a stunning accomplishment. And the law was intended to set up a system where people of significantly low income, or below, officially below the poverty rate, and even a little bit above the poverty rate, could get state insurance through the Medicaid program in their state. However, because of the Supreme Court decision 2 years ago, the Supreme Court said states could not be required to expand their Medicaid program. So many states in this area, Arkansas, Iowa, Illinois, have all expanded their Medicaid programs. Unfortunately, in Missouri and Kansas, they have not. And that has created what some people refer to as a donut hole or a coverage gap, in which people below the poverty level don't qualify for any assistance at all. So this is a really big issue, and I thought maybe Alice could talk a little bit about the chances for getting help for these people and get away from that sort of ironic situation where you don't make enough to have help.
Yes, and both Kansas and Missouri chose not to expand Medicaid. In Kansas, the governor could have made the decision. That did not happen in Missouri. It was the way the state law is structured. It required the General Assembly to vote affirmatively. They did not, and Frank maybe could speak to Kansas, but every day we're losing $5.47 million that would have been coming into the state of Missouri to cover the people that would have been eligible. Now, think about this. Medicaid in Missouri has a very, very low threshold. A family of four, the threshold at 19% of poverty is $4,475. Think about that. Could you pay rent, provide transportation, food, and have a telephone for $4,475 for a family of four? It is a year. It is not possible. And so that's the threshold. So the people between above 19% of poverty who are custodial parents, it can't be single people who are just poor, those are the ones in Missouri that we provide Medicaid for. So above that 90% to 133% are not covered. In our state, we did not provide capacity to bring in Medicaid dollars from the Affordable Care Act. And that, I think, is really unjust and immoral. And what we're trying to do is to convince our legislators in Missouri to put it on the table, put good plans on the table, move it forward, and expand that. Over 300 organizations, starting with the Missouri Chamber, the City of Kansas City, Jackson County Legislature, Jackson County Mental Health Fund, you name it, they're all listed. They support it. The hospitals support it. The insurance companies, the durable medical. So what's to hold us back? Why are we doing this to our own citizens? And we're preventing jobs from happening. I understand 24,000 jobs could have been created if we had expanded Medicaid. So we have a long way to go, but we need people to encourage their legislators to vote affirmatively to have our state pass a law that will expand it so that we can fully participate in the law that was passed in 2010.
I'm going to see if I can get this correct. I know I read an example from states, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'm going to do the best I can to recreate this. That I think I know what I'm talking about here. But when the Affordable Care Act was fashioned, before the Supreme Court decision that allowed states to opt out of the Medicaid expansion, well, the provisions are such that in some states that do not have the Medicaid expansion, it's not only perverse that you don't have the expansion for the people that are in poverty, but they actually pay more for their health care under the Affordable Care Act because they don't have because the subsidies are not available to them. Do I have that within spitting range of being right?
Yes. How the law was set up was that it said, okay, if you're at income of 133% of the poverty level or lower, that's where they drew the line. They said, and that amount is, for a single person, it's about $15,400 or so a year. If you make under that amount, we'll help you get Medicaid coverage. We'll give you Medicaid coverage.
I think that's Thank Obama you. Calling it.
Thank you. I think he's calling. I must have said something wrong. Think about that. That's basically about full-time minimum wage for a single person. If you're minimum wage, we'll cover your health care to make sure you don't get really sick and run up huge bills that you can't pay that are basically shifted to everybody else. So we'll give you Medicaid. For a family of three, that would be income of about $27,000 a year. We'll give you Medicaid up to that amount. The Supreme Court case making it optional, they said, well, states can choose whether to expand Medicaid. So Missouri, they have not. Well, Missouri right now, so Missouri has the same Medicaid system they've had for years, and their eligibility is at the federal minimum. So I used to describe it in a previous life when I used to write about these things. I said, you know, a single mom with two kids who works 10 hours a week at minimum wage is too wealthy to get any help to providing health insurance for her medical bills in Missouri. Now, Kansas is relatively generous. That same single mom with two kids can get Medicaid coverage until she works about 15 hours a week at minimum wage. So think about that. In either state, if you work half-time at minimum wage, you're too wealthy to get any help. And that's what this law was about, to say, hey, we're going to give those people some help. But also, not only just to give them some help, but to keep them healthy, make them more productive workers, help the workforce, but also give them a chance to move up the economic ladder. Because a lot of times people are without who are in sort of low-wage jobs and get stuck there is because they're sick. If they have an illness, well, they miss work. Well, it's not because they're lazy. It's because they're ill. And, if you don't have the money, you don't go to the doctor. So this was not just to help these individual people, although that's an important part of it, but it's also to help our workforce, help our economy. Okay, so that's how the law was set up. There was a slight overlap that if your income was from the poverty level up to 400% of the poverty level. So that was for a single person, it's roughly $11,500 to about $46,000 a year. you don't get free care, like Medicaid, but you do get help. And as your income goes up, you're expected to contribute more to the cost of your coverage. For a family of four, it's from about $23,000 a year up to about $94,000 a year. And at the lowest levels, you're required to, you know, the theme of the law is that everybody has to have skin in the game. But we know that if you're at that lower end of that wage, those wage levels, you don't have much skin to give. So you only have to contribute, you have to contribute something, but you only have to contribute 2% of your income. So somebody who's making $12,000 a year, single person now, they'll be able to, they can go to the, these, the marketplace, buy a plan. They would not have to pay more than $20 a month for a good, solid health insurance policy. Now, a person making $40,000 a month would be expected to pay significantly more, probably up to, say, $350 a month or so. Based on the, but again, it's based on their income. The law doesn't say that healthcare is going to be cheap. What it says is it's going to be within reach. It's going to be affordable. So some people don't like the fact that they're required to start carrying health insurance. But by requiring that, everybody comes out ahead because it puts down, again, puts downward pressure on everybody's insurance costs. The problem with states that do not expand Medicaid is that, well, what about, you know, you get tax credits to basically these discounts on health insurance plans from the poverty level to 400% of the poverty level. But what about people below the poverty level? Well, the law assumed they would have Medicaid. Supreme Court and the state legislatures in Missouri and Kansas said, no, we're not going to give it to you. Even though the federal government picks up the full price for 3 years, and for the next, and the next 3 years, they never pay less than 90%. The typical Medicaid pays about only about 62%. Federal government picks up about 62%. So regular Medicaid is far more expensive for the state. This is an incredible bargain the federal government offered. But the legislatures in Kansas and Missouri have not done it. So what happens to those people below the poverty level? I get calls at work from people who are known as navigators or application counselors who are helping people pick out plans and navigate the marketplace so they can, you know, find the best coverage for them. And I get calls and they say, you know, got a really great person, but they, you know, they've kind of got some illnesses and they're not able to work full time. They make about $10,000 a year. I say, you know, the poverty level for one person is $11,500. If they're below the poverty level, they don't get any help. They have to go home. And the problem for the rest of us is that this doesn't solve the problem of those people getting sick. Just because they don't have health insurance doesn't mean they don't get sick. So when they get sick, they have to end up at the hospital emergency room, and those costs get shifted to everybody else. If we can get them into the Medicaid system, we can save a lot of money. In addition, Alice talked about $5.4 million, I think she said, a day in federal money would be flowing into Missouri to provide this health care, but also all the spin-off jobs that go with a significant health care sector. And right now we've got a situation where if you're below the poverty level, even though you're working, a lot of these people, almost all these people are working, they don't get any help, and it doesn't affect, it doesn't solve the problem.
I'll just as a retired federal employee, you know, I've given a lot of thought over the years of always being attacked for working for the federal government because we're so inefficient. We can't do anything except, of course, land people on the moon, build an interstate highway thing, have World War II, and you know, develop the Internet. But I'm not sure where I was going with that other than a rant. But we did ask a number of people to call in and comment on this. So I'm going to play a couple of the recordings we have. First of all, from Linda Neville, our own Linda Neville from MoveOn.org, and after that, a guy named Clint that called in. And we'll be back live in about 5 minutes.
Is health care only for the old? Well, the GOP has been hot and heavy against the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, they've been touting the idea that thousands of jobs will be lost with the implementation of this program, a lie, but one that I won't get into today. They have also been arguing that young people don't need health care, that we only want them in the plan to lower our rates. Only those of us older folks will benefit from the affordable health care program, and it will be a wasted money for the young. Well, this isn't true, and I wish to address this. So the young don't need health care. Let's see. What about pregnancy and childbirth and possible complications resulting? Sporting and auto accidents, asthma, autism, drug ODs and addiction, emotional issues, pap smears, mammograms, sexually transmitted diseases, severe flu, obesity, food poisoning, just to name a few. Are they immune to cancer or brain tumors, dog bites, diabetes, nutrition issues, gunshot wounds? The list goes on. I'm pushing 70, and I swear I'm healthier than many of our young adults who by nature take risks or live a lifestyle that can be destructive. I've done it myself when I was years younger. I still probably continue to take risks today. We think we're invincible, but we're not. We all tempt fate in one form or another, no matter what our age. For goodness sakes, we now face health risks just because some major industries or corporations want to make more money, thus exposing us to unhealthy air, food, and water, the very basics of life. Obamacare not only provides insurance for emergency situations, but also for preventive medicine. Women, just think about pap smears and breast cancer, and exams. You don't have to be in your 30s to get cancer. Men, think about your own health issues, and just as importantly, your wife and daughters. Please pay no attention to the GOP's parroting their limitless reasons to deny or dissuade you from recognizing the necessity of health care opportunities, or Obamacare, for everyone. Spreading the risk to all ages of the population is not a new idea. It is and has always been the underlying basis of premium pricing. That's what actuarial studies are all about. If you don't believe it, talk to your pediatricians, to your family practitioner, and other doctors, including those in the emergency room. The ER will tell you they don't just see the geriatric crowd. And remember, if you're told you don't qualify for Obamacare because you qualify for expanded Medicaid, which is not available in either Kansas or Missouri, then you need to contact your state representative, senators, and governor in both states and start demanding some action on their part by reversing their decisions to not participate in the federally funded expanded Medicaid program. Remember the saying, only you can prevent forest fires. Well, it's only you who can force your elected officials to provide reasonable and necessary assistance to the poor, the elderly, the uninsured, and unemployed populace. In other words, most Americans. Health care should be for everyone. For more information on the Affordable Health Care Act, go to healthcare.gov. This is Linda Neville with JOCOMoveOn.org. Thanks for listening.
Good evening. This is Clint White, calling to leave a comment about Obamacare. I have these discussions frequently with some conservative members at work, and we discuss the ups and downs of the political system, really them bitching a lot and me explaining the delicacies of the world. With Obamacare being called socialism, my reply is that the whole insurance industry is socialism, in that we all pool our money through our monthly contributions from the employers and the employees that go into a huge pool, or in some cases not employees, goes into a huge pool, and out of that money comes the money that is used for some people's big expensive bills while others don't have any bills. And it also pays for huge, massive salaries for CEOs, managers, and salespeople, as well as huge amounts for advertising and all sorts of other absurdity. So when people argue against Obamacare, screaming socialism and communism, what they're doing is trying to equate a system that could become more efficient with one that has already been essentially a capitalist socialism where the people are somewhat in benefit, but at a high profit margin. So the shame with Obamacare is that it had to be not a single-payer system, but a corporatocracy.
Okay, I want to thank Linda and Clint both for sharing their thoughts on that. I thought Clint's point that the insurance company was itself was socialism, I thought it was interesting. I think it's a semantic thing, whether or not you accept it when it's not a government thing at all. But I think it's very interesting that people want to call this whole thing socialist. They want to call it socialized medicine for one thing. Mostly it's socializing the financing part of it. And plus, I think that the parts of our healthcare system that work the best are the parts that, excuse the phrase, are socialistic, and that would be Medicare. And I'm going to have that's my opinion. I'm sticking to it. But Barbara, why don't you talk a little bit about Medicare and how that fits into this whole picture?
Yes, my name is Barbara Schneider, and when the health care law was being debated in Congress in 2009 and 2010, I am still, a Medicare patient, and I was very concerned about where this was going with Medicare. I had heard the rumors about the negative effects it was going to have on Medicare, and so I began studying the law, reading the law, read the whole thing. And what I found was that that rather than negatively affecting Medicare, there were some wonderful things in the law that helped Medicare patients. One of them was the elimination of that dreaded donut hole in Medicare Part D, the drug prescription plan. It's been beginning to close since 2010, and it will completely close by 2020. So Medicare patients don't have to spend hundreds and thousands of dollars on unanticipated prescription drug costs. Another advantage to Medicare patients is the free preventive care. In fact, Medicare patients have been eligible for that since 2010 as well. We can get our annual wellness examinations for free. We get our testing for free. We get our mammograms if we need them, or colonoscopies, we certainly need them, for free. A number of testing procedures we get with no cost. We also have someone to follow up when we're released from the hospital. Do you realize that 20% of senior patients are returned to the hospital within 30 days for the same condition? 20% of seniors returning to the hospital. Now the hospitals and the doctors and even the insurance companies, I'm finding, are following up with senior citizens if there's no one at home to make sure that they're taking their prescription drugs that were assigned to them when they left the hospital, taking care of them to see that they get to that next doctor's visit. Those are great things for senior citizens. The other thing I'm enthused about as far as the Affordable Care Act is the financial savings for people. Not only the free preventive care, but the ban on lifetime and annual benefit limits or cost limits. You no longer have a maximum benefit for a year or a maximum benefit for lifetime. Those will be continued to be paid throughout your lifetime. There are restrictions on how much an insurance company can increase their premium every year. They're limited to 10% in some states where they can control the premium increase in costs. Out-of-pocket maximum deductibles in your insurance plans now. So you know at the beginning of the year what your out-of-pocket maximum will be. You no longer face a $30,000 hospital bill if you should happen to have to stay for 3 or 4 days. So all of those things are affecting everybody, not only Medicare patients, and even those who have group health insurance through their employer have those new added benefits.
appreciate that. I'm going to change gears just a little bit. I'm going to do a little bit of an editorializing. You guys can comment when I get done with it a little bit. I think probably everyone in this room, if we were starting with a blank slate, would have recognized the value of having a single payer system, just the economies of scale, if nothing else, and the fact that having a checkerboard of several for-profit health companies around the country it seems to me it's obvious that it's not going to be as efficient as you would have if you had a single payer system. Two things that come to mind as far as why I kind of soft-pedaled that a little bit is, you know, I think you have to view politics from two prisms. One, you should never let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And the other thing is that politics is the art of the possible. Anybody looks at this political scene that we have now and thinks we could ever pass single payer at this point, isn't paying very close attention. But I want to have a little bit of discussion on single payer, and I don't want this to be nothing but simply a love fest for Obamacare. I'm going to quote a little bit of Michael Moore's editorial that was in the New York Times. The succinct phrase is Obamacare is awful. He says the Affordable Care Act is a pro-insurance industry plan implemented by a president who knew in his heart that a single payer Medicare for all model was the true way to go. And then it's interesting. I've heard Michael Moore comment two or three times on the Affordable Care Act. And he always at least admits, yeah, there are some good things that go with it. But he does say in that same article, for many people, the affordable part of the Affordable Care Act risks being a cruel joke. The cheapest plan available to a 60-year-old couple making $65,000 a year in Hartford, Connecticut, will cost $11,800 in annual premiums, and their deductible will be $12,600. Now, I can't verify that, but I'm guessing that this is such a massive change with such a large part of our economy. There's bound to be winners and losers, and for some people, I think that, you know, maybe the Affordable Care Act is not such a good deal. And the last part of the editorial is that I also worked for the Social Security Administration for 35 years, and it was amended just about every other year the time I was there. And I did a quick Google search, and since the Social Security Act was passed in 1935, it's been amended 30 times, which is an average of about every 2.5 years. So I don't think it should be surprising that there aren't some things in the Affordable Care Act that the biggest supporters of it recognize that we're going to have to, you know, that it's always an ongoing project. I mean, our healthcare system is not fixed, and not everybody has healthcare. Anybody wants to jump on any of that, go for it.
I just want to say one thing about the cost. Those are, I think, probably real. Those sound like in the ballpark costs for a couple in their early 60s who are making $65,000 a year. Now, if they were making $62,000 a year, they're right at 400% of the poverty level, and they could get very significant discounts. They would be limited to about $500 a month, a little over five, about $550 a month would be the most they would have to pay. If they go to $65,000, he has picked an amount that's just over 400% of the poverty level, and I understand why he's making a point. That is a real situation. They don't get tax credits at that point. Congress decided at over 400% of the poverty level, you know, you pay the whole cost of the insurance plan. And when you're older, insurance companies charge you a lot, but at least now it's limited. Under the law, they can't charge older people more than three times as much as they do younger people. Last year, a typical policy for a couple that side, I mean, in most cases, they couldn't get insurance at any cost because no one would sell it to them. But if they could, it would be probably close to their entire income, especially the woman. Because women who, under the new law now, cannot be discriminated against. They pay the same as men. But the average here in Kansas City, or not average, I'm sorry, a typical typical plan for a woman in over 55 here in Kansas City last year was between $2,000 and $2,500 a month. So that's, you know, between $24,000 and $30,000 a year just for the woman. And for that man, it would probably be about half that much. So they would be paying $27,000, $37,000, $40,000 a year. Essentially, they were just priced out of the market. And that's if anybody would offer it to them. Most companies would just say, no, we don't want you. We're not going to sell it to you. Now insurance companies don't have that choice. And while the price is still expensive because health care is expensive, at least it's within reach. If their income is $65,000 a year, $11,000 is an awful big chunk of that. But it's not completely absurdly out of reach and impossible where previously it was. So,
and I just want to add, in response to your question about wouldn't it be better, and yes, I was supporter of single-payer plan, but I'm also reminded that Harry Truman, his greatest disappointment, he said, in his time as president was not passing universal health care. It's something that we want, and we haven't achieved it. When all of this legislative action came up, prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, actually it's the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, we knew, I've been watching this through the years, it used to be 25 million Americans, I think in the 80s, had no insurance that we document. It was 50 million people in our country. That's unacceptable. And so that we have a plan that accommodate different interests in different ways, I'll take that for the fact that we have projected 30 million people would get some kind of health insurance and have access to it, and now we've dwindled that down to a smaller number because half of our states didn't expand it. So it's a compromise, but I want people to have health insurance. It is unconscionable to live in a country with the resources and know-how and the ability. Yes, we can make it better.
Yes, I would agree with everything everyone has said. When I was in college a few years ago, the private school I went to required me to have health insurance. So I just, you know, I Googled, I looked online, and it was all over the place. I didn't know what I was actually buying, what I was actually paying for. So I just basically, I got a card that said I had insurance. But if I actually had got sick, that wouldn't have covered me at all. I would have been out of luck. I would have had to pay thousands upon thousands of dollars on top of my student loans that I already have if I had got sick really, really badly. But with the healthcare marketplace, it's a side-by-side comparison. True, it's not a single-payer system, but it's something that's easy that I can understand, that other people can understand and go to and see the different comparison in the cost. And, like, and just if they, all we did was just the simple basics of the Affordable Care Act with, you know, not denying people with pre-existing conditions, keeping kids and on their parents' plan until they're 26, making health insurance companies pay for 80% of your premiums have to go towards your care. If that was all that it did, it's a huge step forward on what we had originally had before. It's a huge improvement.
Okay, this is meant to be a magazine show. I want to thank all the guests here. We're just about out of time, and we usually play a segment called the our radioactive global comment, so or global warming. we're gonna end with that. But on this segment, I want to thank everybody here. I think there was a ton of information. There were still a lot of issues I would like to have covered, but it was really great to have such knowledgeable people to lead us on the way, and I didn't get a chance to ask about the excise tax on the Cadillac plans or the multi-employer plans, but that would have probably put everybody to sleep out there anyway, except for the hardcore organized labor friends out there. Sorry, labor. We'll talk about that in the next time. Right now we're going to go to David Mitchell on our global warming segment.
This is Dave Mitchell with Global Warming Corner. In another Global Warming Corner, I had urged all of you to search your hearts for that feeling the ground is slipping irretrievably from beneath our collective feet. For some of you, this feeling may be readily accessible, and others will have difficulty getting there. Some will have it buried deep in their unconscious, which will ultimately cause various disturbances, conscious or not. global warming is a reality. In May 2010, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences produced 5 studies on climate change. One of these studies, Advancing the Science of Climate Change, concluded, climate change is happening. Human activities are largely responsible, and these conclusions are, quote, based on a strong, credible body of evidence. Also, climate change, quote, poses a significant risk for, and in many cases is already affecting, a broad range of human and natural systems. How did it come to this? Beginning with the Industrial Revolution about 1750, humanity has been pumping ever-increasing amounts of fossil fuel pollutants into our atmosphere. In May 2013, National Geographic reported the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii measuring 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. It has been 3 million years since CO2 was that high, with horses and camels living in the high Arctic. Average temperatures were only 3.6 to 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than now. In their online site on climate change, the Environmental Protection Agency reports Earth has warmed 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 100 years. Projections indicate a range of 2 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit additional increase in the next 100 years. Anything even approaching 11 degrees Fahrenheit additional warming would, in my opinion, be a nightmare world with a major collapse of our biosphere. With 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit warming, what has the U.S. experienced so far? A partial list from the Environmental Protection Agency includes the U.S. North, West, and Alaska have had the most warming. Since the 1970s, unusually hot summers are more common, heat waves are more frequent, and since 1990, 8 of the top 10 years for extreme one-day precipitation events has occurred. Precipitation has increased 5% in the last 100 years, with the last 50 years wetter than average. However, the year 2000 to 2012 has seen 30 to 70% of the U.S. in drought conditions at any given time. The last 20 years has seen an increase in tropical cyclones due to warmer waters in the tropical Atlantic. Let us not forget 2012, the warmest year on record for the lower 48. Major drought conditions existed over much of the country with a multitude of wildfires, the loss of 60% of our corn crop. Currently, California has been suffering a terrible drought all of 2013. NBC Bay Area News reported on January 28, 2014, Governor Brown declared a drought emergency for the state. He declared the drought threatens the state with dramatically less water for farms and communities, as well as increased wildfires. The state water project will honor only 5% of requested water deliveries. The state snowpack is only 20% of normal. There could be a devastating impact on California's Central Valley, a significant source of fruits and vegetables for the nation. Let us look north to Alaska. They have been suffering a heat wave the last 2 weeks of January 2014, one of the warmest winter periods in their history, with temperatures as far as 40 degrees Fahrenheit above normal in the central and western parts. On mangabay.com, they cite the Environmental Protection Agency indicating the average temperatures in Alaska have risen 3.4 degrees Fahrenheit over the last 50 years due to, you guessed it, global warming. So, to sum all this up, it's getting hotter, folks, and things aren't pretty in the long term. To avoid the nightmare scenario of approaching 11 degrees Fahrenheit additional warming in the next century, humanity must engage in a transformative process to a truly sustainable global society which lives within the limits of the Earth. Until next time, this is Dave Mitchell with KKFI's Global Warming Corner.
You have been listening to Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced broadcast spotlighting social and political activists in our community. If you'd like more information or like to comment on this program, call Bill Claus at 816-994-7869.
Support for KKFI provided by the weekly forum at All Souls UU Church. This Sunday, March the 2nd at 10 a.m., the forum will feature John Tibbetts, Associate Professor of Theater and Film at KU, leading a conversation predicting and critiquing winners and losers for this year's Oscars. All Souls UU Church is at 4501 Walnut, one block east of Main in Kansas City. More information is at allsoulskc.org. Listen to the All Souls Forum each Wednesday at noon on 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Hi, everybody. This is Danielle Schneblin from Trampled Underfoot, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And a very good evening to you. I am Stormin Norman. I'll be your host for the next 2 hours here at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is the local showcase program, and it comes up every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m., and we give you a different